Over the Edge of the World, Magellan's Terrifying Circumnavigation of the Globe. Written and read by Lawrence Burgreen. On September 6, 1522, a battered ship appeared on the horizon near the port of Sanlúcar de Barrameda, Spain. Her tattered sails flailed in the breeze, her rigging had rotted away, and storms had gouged her sides. A small pilot boat was dispatched to lead the strange ship over the reefs to the harbor. The vessel they were guiding into the harbor was operated by a skeleton crew of just 18 sailors and 3 captives, all of them severely malnourished. Their tongues were swollen and their bodies were covered with painful boils. Their captain was dead, as were the officers. Nearly the entire crew had perished. The pilot boat gradually coaxed the battered vessel past the natural hazards guarding the harbor. The ship, Victoria, slowly began to make her way along the Guadalquivir River to Seville, the city from which she had departed 3 years earlier. No one knew what had become of her since then. Victoria was a ship of mystery, and every gaunt face on her deck was filled with the dark secrets of a prolonged voyage to unknown lands. Despite the journey's hardships, Victoria and her diminished crew accomplished what no other ship had ever done, by sailing west until they reached the east, and then sailing on in the same direction. They had fulfilled an ambition as old as the human imagination, the first circumnavigation of the globe. 3 years earlier, Victoria had belonged to a fleet of 5 vessels, with about 260 sailors, all under the command of Fernão de Magalhães, whom we know as Ferdinand Magellan. A Portuguese nobleman and navigator, he had left his homeland to sail for Spain with a charter to explore undiscovered parts of the world and claim them for the Spanish crown. The expedition he led was among the largest and best equipped in the Age of Discovery. Now Victoria and her ravaged crew were all that was left. Many had died in excruciating death, some from scurvy, others by torture, and a few by drowning. Worse, Magellan, the captain general, had been brutally killed. Despite her brave name, Victoria was not a ship of triumph. She was a vessel of desolation and anguish. And yet, what a story those few survivors had to tell, a tale of mutiny, of orgies on distant shores, and of the exploration of the entire globe. A story that changed the course of history and the way we look at the world. In the Age of Discovery, many expeditions ended in disaster and were quickly forgotten. Yet this one, despite the misfortunes that befell it, became the most important maritime voyage ever undertaken. This circumnavigation forever altered the Western world's ideas about cosmology, the study of the universe and our place in it, as well as geography. It demonstrated, among other things, that the Earth was round, that the Americas were not part of India, but were actually a separate continent, and that oceans covered most of the Earth's surface. The voyage conclusively demonstrated that the Earth is, after all, one world. But it also demonstrated that it was a world of unceasing conflict, both natural and human. The cost of these discoveries in terms of loss of life and suffering was greater than anyone could have anticipated at the start of the expedition. They had survived an expedition to the ends of the earth, but more than that, they had endured a voyage into the darkest recesses of the human soul. On June 7, 1494, Pope Alexander VI divided the world in half, bestowing the western portion on Spain and the eastern on Portugal. Matters might have turned out differently if the pontiff had not been a Spaniard, Rodrigo de Borja, born near Valencia, but he was. Alexander VI was a rather secular pope, among the wealthiest and most ambitious men in Europe, fond of his many mistresses and his illegitimate offspring, and endowed with sufficient energy and ability to indulge his worldly passions. he brought the full weight of his authority to bear on the appeals of King Ferdinand and Queen Isabella, the Catholic monarchs of Spain, who had instituted the Inquisition in 1492 to purge Spain of Jews and Moors. Ferdinand and Isabella wanted the Pope's blessing to protect the recent discoveries made by Christopher Columbus, the Genoese navigator who claimed a new world for Spain. Portugal threatened to assert its own claim to the newly discovered lands, as did England and France. Ferdinand and Isabella implored Pope Alexander VI to support Spain's title to the New World. He responded by issuing solemn edicts establishing a line of demarcation between Spanish and Portuguese territories around the globe. The line extended from the North Pole to the South Pole. It was located 100 leagues, or about 400 miles, west of an obscure archipelago known as the Cape Verde Islands, in the Atlantic Ocean off the coast of North Africa. Antonio and Bartolomeo da Noli, Genoese navigators sailing for Portugal, had discovered them in 1460, and ever since the islands had served as an outpost in the Portuguese slave trade. The papal bulls granted Spain exclusive rights west of the line. The Portuguese, naturally, were supposed to keep to the east, and if either kingdom happened to discover a land ruled by a Christian ruler, neither would be able to claim it. Rather than settling disputes, this arrangement touched off a furious race between the nations to claim new lands and to control the world's trade routes. The bickering over the line's location continued as diplomats convened in Tordesillas, Spain, to work out a compromise. In Tordesillas, the Spanish and Portuguese representatives agreed to abide by the idea of a papal division, which seemed to protect the interests of both parties. At the same time, the Portuguese prevailed on the Spanish representatives to move the line 270 leagues west. Now it lay at approximately 46 degrees 30 minutes west, according to modern calculations. This change placed the boundary roughly halfway between the Cape Verde Islands and the Caribbean island of Hispaniola. The new boundary gave the Portuguese ample access to the African continent by water and allowed them to claim the newly discovered land of Brazil. Pope Alexander VI was succeeded by Pope Julius II, who in 1506 agreed to the changes, and the Treaty of Tordesillas achieved its final form. The treaty created more problems than it solved. It was impossible to fix the line's location because cosmologists did not yet know how to determine longitude. The treaty also failed to specify whether the line of demarcation extended all the way around the globe or just bisected the Western Hemisphere. Finally, not much was known about the location of oceans and continents. Even if the world was round, the maps of 1494 depicted a very different planet from the one we know today. Emboldened by the Treaty of Tordesillas, Ferdinand and Isabella looked for ways to exploit the portion of the globe granted to Spain. Success proved elusive. Columbus's voyages to the New World all failed to find a water route to the Indies. A generation after Columbus, King Charles I resumed the quest to establish a Spanish global empire. He, or his advisors, recognized that the Indies could provide priceless merchandise, and the most precious commodity of all was spices. Spices have played an essential economic role in civilization since antiquity. Like oil today, the European quest for spices drove the world's economy and influenced global politics. Spices became inextricably intertwined with exploration, conquest, and imperialism. The mere mention of their names, white and black pepper, myrrh, frankincense, nutmeg, cinnamon, cassia, mace, and cloves, to name a few, evoked the wonders of the Orient and the mysterious East. Arab merchants traded in spices over land routes, reaching across Asia, and became adept at boosting prices by concealing the origins of the cinnamon, pepper, cloves, and nutmeg with which they enriched themselves. The merchants maintained a virtual monopoly by insisting these precious items came from Africa, when in fact they grew in various places in India and China, and especially throughout Southeast Asia. To protect their monopoly, Arab spice merchants invented all sorts of monsters and myths to conceal the ordinary process of harvesting spices. The spice trade was central to the Arab way of life. Arabs developed sophisticated methods of extracting essential oils from aromatic spices used for medical and other therapeutic purposes. During the Middle Ages, Arab knowledge of spices spread across Western Europe, where apothecaries developed a brisk trade in concoctions made from cloves, pepper, nutmeg, and mace. In a Europe starved for gold, spices became more valuable than ever, a major component of European economies. Despite the overwhelming importance of spices to their economy, Europeans remained dependent on Arab merchants for their supply. They knew the European climate could not sustain these exotic spices. In the 16th century, the Iberian Peninsula was far too cold, colder than it is now in the grip of the Little Ice Age, and too dry to cultivate cinnamon, cloves, and pepper. Under the traditional system, spices, along with damasks, diamonds, opiates, pearls, and other goods from Asia, reached Europe by slow, costly, and indirect routes over land and sea. Along the way, spices went through as many as 12 different hands, and every time they did, their prices shot up. The global spice trade underwent an upheaval in 1453, when Constantinople fell to the Turks. The time-honored overland spice routes between Asia and Europe were severed. The prospect of establishing a spice trade via an ocean route opened up new economic possibilities for any European nation able to master the seas. For those willing to assume the risks, the rewards were irresistible. The lure of spices impelled sober, cautious financiers to back highly risky expeditions to unknown parts of the globe and enticed young men to risk their lives. In Spain, the best and perhaps the only reason to risk going to sea was the prospect of getting rich in the Spice Islands, wherever they were. If a sailor devoted years of his life to getting there and back, and if he managed to bring home a small sack stuffed with spices, such as cloves or nutmeg, legitimately or not, he could live off the proceeds for the rest of his life. And a captain had a right to expect much more than that in the age of discovery, not only vast riches and fame, but titles to pass on to his heirs and foreign lands to rule. There was ample precedent for Magellan's emigration to Spain. His boyhood hero, Christopher Columbus, had come to Spain from Genoa to seek backing for the discovery of a route to the Indies. Magellan believed that he could do what the Genoese navigator had claimed to do, but had never actually accomplished, reach the fabulous Indies by sailing westward across the ocean. Tensions ran so high between Spain and Portugal that an international incident could result from an expedition following this route. Portugal had long been notoriously secretive about its empire, almost as secretive as the Arabs had been. By an edict of the Portuguese king, announced on November 13, 1504, anyone revealing discoveries or plans for missions of exploration could be executed. Magellan brought with him many of Portugal's most precious and sensitive secrets. Information about secret expeditions, a familiarity with Portuguese activity in the Indies, and an acquaintance with Portuguese navigational knowledge of the world beyond Europe. He was a rare breed, an explorer, schooled in the royal tradition established by Prince Henry the Navigator, but he needed a sponsor. At 18, Charles I, King of Castile, Aragon, and León, was keenly aware of his august antecedents. He had preceded Magellan to Spain by only a year and was as much of a stranger or more. A Habsburg, he had come of age in Flanders, drinking beer and speaking Flemish. He was now trying to learn the Spanish language and Spanish customs as quickly as he could. His thirst for fame and glory had become apparent as soon as he arrived in Spain, and it was encouraged by his advisors, most of them highly placed officials of the church who had been in power since the days of Ferdinand and Isabella. Less than a year after coming to Spain, Charles was elected King of the Romans, thanks to a great deal of string-pulling by members of his family. The appointment meant that he would eventually become crowned King Charles V, Emperor of the Holy Roman Empire. But to receive the title, he would have to pay vast sums of money, essentially bribes, to the electors, and he looked to the Indies and the New World as a source of revenue to advance his personal ambitions. The timing of Magellan's arrival in Spain was auspicious, but his overall prospects were decidedly mixed. He was an unknown quantity to the Spanish court and ministers. He spoke Spanish haltingly, and he relied on scribes for written communication in that language. He had renounced his loyalty to Portugal, but he remained an outsider in Spain, on probation and under suspicion. In these difficult circumstances, getting the financial backing for his proposed voyage would require a superhuman expenditure of effort and cunning, as well as a generous amount of luck. The provisions of the Treaty of Tordesillas posed serious obstacles for the proposed expedition. Members of the Casa failed to see how Magellan could avoid trespassing on Portuguese interests by sailing west until he reached the east. Anticipating this objection, Magellan referred to a clause in the Treaty of Tordesillas that allowed Spain or Portugal the freedom of the seas to reach lands belonging to one empire or the other. Such a clause was open to many interpretations. Then there was the question of Magellan's nationality. The prospect of a Portuguese leading a Spanish expedition through Portuguese waters made nearly everyone at the Casa uneasy. If the Portuguese became aware of the expedition, relations between the two countries might be strained to the breaking point. Magellan's conception of the world he planned to explore was fatally inaccurate. Like most explorers of the Age of Discovery, his ideas about the size of the globe and location of landmasses were inspired by Ptolemy. Had Magellan comprehended the true size of the Pacific, its currents, storms, and reefs, it is unlikely that he would have dared to mount such an expedition. The estimated length of his route came to only half the actual distance. Magellan confidently predicted that it would take him at most 2 years to reach the Spice Islands and return to Spain with ships bulging with precious cargo. All he would have to do was find a way to get through South America, and he would be at the doorstep of the Indies. This was nearly the same mistake that Columbus had made over and over during his four voyages, and it was a mistake that would be corrected only at the cost of great suffering and of many lives during the voyage Magellan now proposed.